Good morning, everyone. What a pleasure to see all the bright, smiley faces today. Ready and eager to get to work. So please open the phone lines. Anthony, are you there?
I'll phone lines now.
Okay, thank you.
Could we check if Lorian...
Right. Has Lorian called in?
Yes, I'm here.
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
For a new mom, you are really prompt. Eh? Thank you. And, okay, so welcome back. Just to recap a little bit, yesterday we finished work on 9 metrics, 3 of which were passed. That leaves only 25 to go. And I think it's obvious that we can't get through 25 and do a really good job in one day. Yet that's all the time we have together. So Karen and I and Helen and Karen have a new process in mind that I've agreed to. I think that will be better, and she will explain it to us in a few minutes. But before we go into that, I'd like to invite Lauren to kind of recap what happened with the last set of metrics that we passed at our last meeting in January. For those who were involved, maybe you'd like to know what's happened to our work.
Mm-hmm. So I know, good morning, everyone. I know it's been some time since you last heard what happened with the last round of measures. So on July 13th, our Consensus Standards Approval Committee, our CSAC as we call them, they approved all 10 measures that will move forward. Now, originally the committee put forward 11 measures, but CMS since then withdrew their lower limit hemoglobin measure, so that made it 10. The CSAC approved all 10. The board recently ratified the CSAC's decision. Just last week it was. The press release has gone out. The measures are now endorsed. However, we have a 30-day appeals process for the measures, and that began on yesterday. So towards the end of, middle of September, we will have the appeals come in. We'll look at them again. Depending on what the appeals say and how many we get, we may have to go back to the board and or the CSAC, depending on the content of the appeals. So after that, we'll see what happens. So to give you another.
So it can really take almost a year from the time we finish our work until, you know, it's, the metrics have stepped through all the process and everybody's had a chance to give feedback and so on. Christine and I attended by phone the CSAC meeting, and it was interesting. While they eventually approved all of the 10 metrics that were left, there's a lot of discussion, one on how distal the outcomes were to the outcomes we wanted, particularly the new pediatric metrics. And they were very concerned about that. And one of some of the other big concerns was
the frequency and assessment measures.
Yeah.
That was a major concern for the...
So as a heads up to the committee, they're looking for more and more proximal outcomes or the outcomes themselves.
Can I ask a question on that?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were too, and yet those measures were not submitted to us. So, you know, obviously we didn't get what we wanted as a committee. So how do we get what we want?
Well, that came up in discussion. They said, well, the steering committee doesn't write the metrics, and it's not our, we have to deal with what we have. And they did understand that pediatric nephrology had nothing, and it's better to have something to start out than nothing, and that, and they understand that we would, that as a committee, we would have preferred to have been able to deliver, quote, better metrics. Okay? So I just thought you'd like to know what had happened and what will happen with this work. Okay, I'd like to ask Karen to describe a different approach to our work to try to make our time together as productive as it can be, give the metrics their full due.
Okay.
Okay, so I know this has been hard work for everyone, and we really appreciate you hanging with it. As Peter noted, we have 25 measures to go, and obviously there's no way we're going to do that today, continuing on our process. So I did confer with Helen Burstyn last night, and certainly after your suggestions, and so what we thought could work is that rather than doing any voting today, that we try to address each measure so that we can identify strengths and weaknesses, issues that need clarification, make sure that anything like that is fully discussed here, and then we will ask you to actually register your votes online after the meeting. We'll compile the preliminary give you the preliminary evals again and any of the discussion points from the meeting and then vote online. And then we'll have a conference call where we'll discuss the results of that voting. The thinking is that, you know, since we have you here collectively, we want to take advantage of having you all here things together, as well as we've got the measure developers here to do clarification. And so we thought that that would be the best use of our face-to-face time. But I'll just stop there and see if anyone has any major concerns about that or if you think that will be workable.
We're not going to have the voting
time. No. Yes. Alan?
I'm troubled by it. I'm troubled because the process that we've had has been one in which the voting is informed by the discussions that we've just had. And if we're going to have 25 measures or what fraction are left that we're going to be voting on remotely, touching and remembering and feeling the content of those discussions, I think will be difficult.
Ruben?
In that same direction, I have concerns about doing it that way because the voting is the easiest. It's the discussion takes time. So it's a lot easier if we have it fresh in our mind while we do this.
I hear what you're saying, but I don't see us being able to make things quick enough to get through even a substantial, and then we would have many phone calls to try to do that as well. So I hear what you're saying. I don't know. Anyone else? Peter?
Well, the counterbalancing argument, though, is that we would have to go so fast and we would have to be voting on metrics. And frankly, speaking for myself, I didn't absorb the full content of 34 metrics and the validity and all these arguments. And I think that it would be, the product will be better because we will have given a little more consideration and a little bit more time and not rush through it. So that's the opposite side. I do recognize it is a change in process and it is asking for perhaps a little more from all of you. But having committed so much to this process already, I hope that you'll be willing to do that.
Another, Rick had an idea yesterday, which in essence was a subcommittee phone call just before we come here. You already have us grouped mm-hmm. by different.
Right.
And what Ruben and I did yesterday at lunch is have a brief session of, you know, this is yours, probably not good, this one, maybe this one's discussable, et cetera. So there was a quick check where there was feelings of unanimity among the people that had reviewed them so that we could be on the same page. So that might really hasten the process.
Right.
The other option I think you really have to consider, if there has been so much energy expended on this, do we need to spend the third day here?
Right. Would anyone spend a third day here? I think that's an excellent suggestion, and we can certainly try to work that, you know, have those subcommittee phone conference calls prior to the meeting. I think that's a good suggestion of Jeff.
I would be inclined to agree with Alan and Ruben. I think we ought to do a really, really good job with as many metrics as we can, and then leave the rest for another day, rather than what I think would force us to do a less good job with everything. If we got through them the way that you suggested, and maybe we can figure out some other way to deal with whatever we can't get through today.
Lisa?
Maybe, and I'm sort of two minds of this. I don't know that we should just systematically go through these in order. I think we should prioritize either the easy ones and get them done, or the controversial ones, because I think those will benefit from the face-to-face discussion. And so maybe before we start for the day, we should, I know we have to start with mortality, but maybe we should do a scan of the metrics that are left and try to prioritize. But I do like Rick's idea, not for us at this meeting, but for future meetings, of having a subgroup meeting ahead of time and have them do that prioritization. Yep, this is clearly out. Yep, this is clearly in. These are the ones that really need to be discussed in detail at the meeting. I absolutely agree, although I think the easy ones are the ones that are easiest to do over the phone. Because for me, it's great value being in the room with the more complicated ones that we really need to think through very clearly. So that would be my suggestion. I think prioritizing is a great idea.
Okay, well, why don't we take a poll?
Can I just suggest that the easy ones are the ones that are re-upping, that have already been reviewed once before, and for which there is just a, you know, the additional amount to talk about what's happened since the last review. The harder ones are the ones that we're looking at for the first time.
Okay, so let's get a pulse of the group and see whether you want to continue on as we did yesterday. We'll put that forward as, or we can have the discussion, you know, be sure that we address each of the measures today and then follow up online and conference call. So I'll put forward the question of who is in favor of continuing the voting. And
so A is original and B is the modified.
Right. So we'll just do a show of hands since we didn't give you your remotes yet, but those who are in favor of continuing on as we were yesterday, raise your hand. Right. Right.
Okay, one. Is that a yes, Andrew? One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten.
And Lori, it is a yes.
It's going to be the majority,
right,
obviously,
okay.
I guess.
Max on the line? Max Hay? Okay.
He's doing a couple of minutes. Maybe
okay.
We can have...
All right. So I think what we will do then is we will start with the mortality measure. But I'd like to... Maybe we'll just take a minute to identify some priority issues that we need to discuss. So out of the measure, you know, I think everyone would agree we need to discuss the mortality measure. There's it's complicated and there are some issues that we need to get resolved. From the list of measures, are there any others that people would want to identify as high priority, you know, based on your review? There are also some issues with the older ones, though, that we need, yeah. So, but we could start with the new ones and then, I mean, is that what, any other suggestion about new versus? Also, Lauren, are there any other measure developers that we're going to be on? Okay. All right. So, is Max on the line?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, hi Max, this is Karen.
Karen.
We're about to start. We're going to have CMS do a brief introduction of the mortality measure, and then we will ask you to just do a little presentation of the things that you provided in your statistical analysis, and then we'll have a discussion. Is that okay?
Yes, sure.
Okay. So who from Arbor is going to, okay, Bob?
Bob Wolf from Arbor Research, and I understand that there are some issues related to the mortality that would be worthwhile discussing here, and I think it's a very interesting and important discussion which highlights the distinction between achieving the goals versus maybe following the standard practice. So with regard to mortality, mortality is a fundamental outcome, so the questions of evidence and so on don't matter for mortality. But the real issue having to do with mortality is in the question of the adjustment for patient characteristics and the adequacy of that adjustment. And Lauren, if you could show the slide related to the different deciles, that's figure 3, and this was sent to the committee, and what it shows is how the mortality varies amongst different groups of patients according to their predicted risk from the adjustment process. Those of you who have the handouts, it is in figure 3 from the analyses that we sent.
It would be in the document that we sent, the measure developer responses. And
what it was, can you see it? No, it's above there. It's half.
It's on page.
That's it.
There you go. And Max and Lorianne, it's on in that measure developer response PDF. It's on page 33, figure
3. Okay.
What this shows is very very widespread between the deciles of risk predicted and the actual mortality that is seen for those 10 different groups, from the lowest mortality with the highest survival at the top to the highest mortality or the lowest survival curve, number 10 at the bottom. Now, this is always, I will say that adjustment for patient characteristics is always glass half full, glass half empty. This is the good part of the story. There is a lot of discrimination between different patients with regard to the patient characteristics and our ability to predict the actual mortality that they will see. This is never a finished product in that we are always looking for new covariates, new factors that are predictive of mortality that can be and appropriately should be included in the model. Some examples of that are given. I'm not going to take you through it, but below there's an example showing the careful modeling issues that have been dealt with regard to BMI and also race by age, which we have had in our model with an interaction for over a decade, similar to the Hopkins result that has just recently been published. But ours is not as pronounced, and I'm very interested in why it's a little bit different, even though it's effectively the same. And I think that part of the explanation may come in what you'll see today. The question before us is whether to adjust for race in this model. And let me explain why there are reasons not to. You may say, well, if it's predictive, you should always adjust for anything that's predictive. There may be reasons not to, and it has to do with a goal which was articulated by the NQF in a query to us, which is We do not want to obscure disparities in access to quality care for minorities. So here's the problem. If minorities are getting worse outcomes for one reason or another, and if we adjust for that, then we would say, well, that's just what's expected. So a facility that has lower, worse outcomes for the minority patients would be okay, because they would say, well, that's what we expect. That's what we see. If you adjust for what you see, then that becomes the expectation, and you say, it's okay to be as expected. Are you with me? So facilities that treat a lot of minorities might have worse outcomes because they're giving, perhaps, or minorities are getting poor care at those facilities, at all facilities, but those facilities that have more minorities would have their outcomes excused because it's as expected. That's the problem, that, at least as I understand it, that raises the concern about why we should or should not adjust. If you adjust, you sweep it under the rug and say, okay, it's okay, it's as expected. That happens when outcomes for minorities are worse than for other patients. What we have in ESRD is a different situation. In study after study, and this is not unique to our analyses, it has been seen that for whatever reason, and I don't think anybody really knows the reasons, blacks on dialysis have better outcomes than whites of the same age. The Hopkins results suggest that may be reversed at the lower end, but most blacks in the age range 40 to 70, 80 have better outcomes. And it's substantially so. It's about 25% so. So I'd like you to move to figure one, if possible. It's just a couple of pages above there, Lauren. Thank you. What this shows is mortality from two different models. And I want to focus first upon the red dashed line, which shows an unadjusted model where we do not adjust for race. And the mortality is shown on the vertical axis. And what we have done is grouped facilities into, I believe, 10 different groups according to their case mix with regard to percent black. The facilities on the right are those who have a high percentage black in their case mix. The facilities on the left are those facilities with a low percentage black in their case mix. And what the red line shows is a general downward trend. It shows that facilities treating more blacks have better outcomes. If you don't account for the fact that they're treating more blacks, they just do have lower mortality. My explanation for that is, that's because blacks have lower mortality for whatever reason, and the facilities that have a lot of blacks consequently have low mortality because they have that case mix that does have lower mortality. Just as facilities, if they were treating young patients, would have lower mortality than facilities treating old patients, because old people have higher death rates than young people. Same here. Facilities that treat blacks have lower death rates because blacks have lower death rates, not necessarily because they have. Well, the question becomes then, why is there that downward trend? I've given you one explanation. Another explanation is those facilities are better. And that's the naive interpretation that you would have if you just look at that. Facilities with treating more blacks have lower mortality, and maybe that's because they're giving better care. In contrast, if you adjust for race and say, we expect better outcomes amongst blacks, and then compare the observed mortality at these facilities to that expectation, then it turns out that those facilities which have low mortality because they're treating, I'll say, patients who should have low mortality, end up having higher than expected mortality. That's shown in the blue line. The blue line shows the adjusted mortality adjusted for race. If you compare the mortality at those facilities to what would be expected given the fact that blacks are expected to have lower death rates, then they actually have higher death rates than you would expect for the mix of blacks that they have. And the facilities with few blacks have lower mortality than you would expect given their mix of patients. I think it's really important to make sure you understand that. So please, are there questions about those two curves? And it has to do with compared to what you would expect, either what you'd expect given the race in blue or what you'd expect ignoring race in red. Alan?
Can I, before we jump in here, let me just ask, the statistical review you got from Max was before we got this response.
I never saw the statistical review from Max.
Pardon me?
I never saw any statistical review from
no,
Max.
No, I'm talking to the steering committee.
Oh,
now,
thank you. I'm sorry.
Our statistical consultant. So, Max, do you have any questions or any, based on the response we got from CMS about the risk model or the race and ethnicity in the model?
Yeah, I do have a question. So in figure one, the Saudi line, is that from the current model being submitted, the actual two-step modeling?
The blue line is from the model which is being submitted,
okay,
which adjusts for the within facility race effect. We distinguish between block and within block effects, or within facility and between facility effects, and we are adjusting only for the within facility effect in the blue line. And that, we believe, clarifies rather than obscures the disparity in healthcare available to blacks. Because
yeah, I totally agree with that. So if minority actually go to works for facility and they actually have better outcomes, then adjusting for that can better differentiate between the facility. And in that case, I'm looking at a parameter coefficients from the Excel spreadsheet, and it seems that the blacks actually have worse outcomes. Is that true?
Right.
I'm looking at categorical black 0 versus 1, and then it's ethnic minus.
No, because the reason it's complicated is because there are interactions of race with age, and that's been documented in quite a few studies. So it's important to put all of the factors involving race into the equation. There is no single number that compares blacks to whites in that spreadsheet that you have, but you have to calculate it for each age, and then you will see that actually blacks have better outcomes than whites at every age in that spreadsheet.
Okay.
Okay? So that explains what appears to be this contradiction between these two curves. But it is because blacks actually have better outcomes on dialysis than whites. That's not true for transplantation.
Okay. We'll stop there for a minute and see what questions the committee has.
We always have to be very wary of confounders when we look at data like this, and I wonder if you do a similar analysis for age, that is, deciles of age, and then units done exactly this way, what that would look like.
That's an excellent question, and the answer is, if you had deciles of age here, the red line would go up. And it does go up. That is, facilities treating older patients have higher mortality because they have...
Right. And then adjusted for age?
Perfectly flat.
Okay.
Perfectly flat. I'm sorry. It's not... It was closer to flat. And it turns out that facilities treating older patients... This is going to get complicated. Do better with older patients. Facilities treating younger patients do better with younger patients, so that actually the mortality came down on both ends a little bit. And I'm not going to try and explain why that might be true, but it appears to be true. I believe that... go ahead, Jerry.
This may be a naive question, but are there other risk adjustment formulas, models that would bring the blue line back to a ratio of closer to one?
Yes. Another analysis which looks at the overall race effect, including the effect of within facility and between facility simultaneously, attributes it all to race and adjusts for it, and then it becomes flat. The analysis that we have done tries to separate the facility effect, that is the between facility effects, which is shown in the blue line, from the race effect within facility, so that you can understand what components of the higher or lower mortality are due to facility and which component might be due to race for whatever reason that is. And I'm using race because it may be a socioeconomic effect that could stand for lots of different things here. There is I do think it's important to go to the next figure, figure two, which is the same as the blue line in figure one, except it's broken out by race of the patients at each of these facilities. So again, the horizontal axis groups facilities according to the percent black. So facilities on the right are those in regions treating a high percentage of black patients. Well, those on the left are those in regions treating a low percentage of black patients. Actually, you'll see that 10% of facilities have zero black patients. There's a dot on the red line, an extra dot on the red line for those 10% of facilities that have no black patients. But in those facilities, we then calculated the mortality for white patients, shown in red, and the mortality for black patients, shown in blue. And what this shows is all patients being treated at the facilities that treat a lot of blacks have higher than expected mortality compared to what would be expected for their race. And all patients treated at the facilities who treat a lot of whites have better than expected mortality for their race. If you want to see disparities in healthcare, I think it's important to understand that this is what the adjusted analysis shows and what the unadjusted analysis shows. I will say I am not trying to be a proponent of whether to adjust here or not, but I think this committee and I think CMS has to be aware of the consequences of adjusting or not adjusting in this rather unique situation where blacks have better mortality than whites. And we don't know. I mean, we are the contractor to CMS. We are currently giving advice to CMS. We don't know what CMS will say about this either. We just want to present the facts to you so that you can understand them and then make a knowledgeable decision.
Is this something that's known? I mean, is it known among the nephrology community that blacks have better outcomes than whites?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
You might turn your mic, but as long as my mic is on, I would say this is well known, and in the research I've been involved with, though, which doesn't look at facility effect, but the age adjustment takes away the mortality advantage of blacks, largely, in other studies, and not looking at facility effect at all. But it's pretty well known. The prevalence of blacks on dialysis is about 3.2 times non-blacks.
I had one question, and maybe this is also naive, but when it comes to transplantation, for whatever reason, one could make the argument that African Americans are transplanted either at a lesser rate, at a different rate, they have immunologic issues. Now, the question is, if we adjusted transplantation rates, would this change? Because, I mean, the point I'm trying to make is when you transplant the creme de la creme, if you will, of the good patients, and then unfortunately, the patients who cannot be transplanted have a higher mortality for obvious reasons. So there's the question.
So this is not a question of a measure that's being put forward, but in fact, the dialysis facility reports do report transplant rates. Those are not adjusted for race for exactly the reason that you brought up. And this is an example where I believe that the solution that you propose might depend upon the particular situation that you're facing. And when there are disparities in a direction adverse to minorities, you may make a different choice, perhaps.
Lauren, could you bring up their spreadsheet with the coefficients or the comorbidity index?
I have a question, though. This figure, too, doesn't that seem to suggest that there's a strong facility effect independent of race to a degree? I think this is very elegant the way this is done, and I think you nicely have laid out the argument that here it seems to suggest that there are outcomes to some degree, how you look at the lines, are paralleling for whites and African Americans, which there's something with the facility that is outside of someone's racial group, which to me then would argue that probably adjusting for it makes
But this should be published. I mean, if this is really not out there, it needs to be published.
Because
the thing that's not there is the separation of the race effect, the better race effect from the facility effect. And it wasn't until this question was raised that we actually looked at it in this particular way. Although we had seen it before, but had not published it.
Because I think the question was, is this measure was supposed to be looking at a facility effect, right? And I think, therefore, if you look at that curve, I think it shows that it's getting at the facility effect, where both races are paralleling with the facility effect. So to me, then, it seems like we should be adjusting for that. But the observed and the expected formula is not unreasonable.
Bob, could you just explain then on this table? Can you freeze the pane so we can see the heading? Is this the coefficients, the log of BMI? What? So, I think in one of these, black had a higher hazard than white. I'm just trying to figure out which of these we could look at, which table we should look at to see what.
If those are the coefficients, and it looks like they are, there will be a coefficient for black. But since there are interactions with other factors, that will be the discrepancy for black versus white for the reference group, and I cannot tell right now which is the reference group. And then that effect would be modified through its interaction with, I believe it's both sex and age. So the difference between black and white mortality depends upon the person's age and gender. So a single number, there is no single number that summarizes the entire comparison. And in fact, the way models are set up, the number for black will only compare to one particular subgroup. I'm not sure if that addresses your question. And may I let Jeff speak to this because he knows more of the details of this spreadsheet.
So I'll just note that the particular sheet you're looking at now are the mean values used for imputing the comorbidity index and the BMI. There's a sheet on there on the bottom. There's, I believe, coefficients.
Okay.
Oh, so that was actually showing that blacks have higher comorbidity. Is that right? Okay. Not that they have higher mortality.
Clarify which spreadsheet we're looking at.
It was in the folder with the information for measure 0369, and it was titled SMR models. And we're in the that's the file, and we're in the worksheet labeled coefficients. Okay.
And in this spreadsheet, if you look at line 18, race, black, and that will be compared to the reference group of white, the coefficient is minus 0.25. It is common to set up that coefficient so that that's a representative group, and I believe that that's what was done here. That's probably the typical age. And it shows about 25% lower mortality for blacks than for whites. At whichever age group this is, and we can look through that.
Sorry about this, Max, but the highest column, is that the 0 versus 1? So what does that mean, under the role of race black?
Yes, black was coded as 1 for this particular covariate, and the reference group, white, were coded as 0. The reference group was chosen as the largest group in order to give the most stable estimate.
Yeah, I agree, but what is the estimate representing for the categorical? Is that 0 versus 1, so it seems it's unblack versus black? Is that how
No, that's black versus white. Because there are separate dummies for four different race, three of the four different race groups. Black has its own indicator variable. Asian Pacific Islander has its own indicator, and Native American has its own indicator. So each can be compared to the reference group. They can also be compared to each other by looking at differences between the estimates.
John, I don't understand that part. Are we looking at a spreadsheet with the coefficients, all the coefficients, and second column is type?
Yes.
They're categorical, so it's a 0 versus 1. That's the only part that confuses me. So I think what you have explained, it should be 1 versus 0. You're comparing black yes versus black no.
Thank you. I know I misunderstood your comment, and I think you're correct. That would be more accurate and clearer. Yes, thank you.
So
that is black versus white.
So in that case, we present the black effect. What age do we use as a comparison group? Of course, I think there's a black and age interaction, so you have to compare maybe 3 years of black and 40 years of white. Is that right? So. What is the age point that you choose in this presentation?
I would need to check with the analyst to be confident. I believe the way the labels in the first column A are given, that might be at age 0, but I'm not positive. There are age splines, which are continuous linear functions, and I'm guessing that the reference group is set up as age 0, so that is not a very meaningful comparison. However, if you look at the spline plots in figure, I believe it's 5 or 6 that we alluded to, they are relatively parallel for both blacks and whites.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think if the reference is 0 right now, then that basically means for patients younger than 18 years old, black have a higher rate, and for patients older than 18 years old, black patients have a lower rate.
If we
are asked all these questions, just want to make sure the direction to which the minority is driving the result. And I think I totally agree with you. If the minorities actually have better outcomes, then adjusting for that will better differentiate between the facilities.
Okay. All right, let's, Joe.
Bob, that's amazing data, and I think I understand the questions, and a profound observation has been made here. But I'm not a statistician that does spline plots and other things. So let me phrase the question this way. In my dialysis unit, it's 91% African American, and my SMR is, say, 0.8 currently. And as I understand it, the possibilities are either that's simply because I have a predominance of blacks, or we could be providing better care. Or both. So, specifically, that SMR right now is adjusted for race. And what you're proposing, if it's not adjusted for race, will it then answer the question, better care or simply predominance of blacks? You know, how is the physician in the community going to interpret any changes we make here, and can that information be conveyed in an important way to address the primary issue of race and mortality?
So, right now, the 0.8 is adjusted for race. So, plausibly, your mortality amongst your white patients is only 80% as high as for similar white patients across the country, and the same for black patients. Actually, we don't know that, but that's the usual interpretation given to the 0.8 is it's 0.8 for all subgroups. If we have not adjusted, and the attribution, the appropriate interpretation is that's because you're giving good quality care. If we had not adjusted for race, your SMR would probably be about 0.6 or 0.7. But we wouldn't know if that was because of good care or just because you're treating a lot of blacks. Neither one could have led to lower mortality.
The more relevant issue would be a facility that had an SMR of 1. It's those facilities that have a high percentage of blacks that would be performing well if it was not adjusted for race. When adjusted for race, they would be performing more poorly. That and it's not reflective in the SMR because of they're getting an advantage from having a higher population of African Americans if it was not adjusted.
Part of the question eventually comes down to is if there's a survival advantage with African Americans and there's uneven distribution across facilities, how much of that is attributed to care or things being done at the facility versus in something else unrelated to a facility effect? And I don't know if anyone knows how much of it's unrelated or related to a facility effect. Figure seems to suggest that there's a large component that is unrelated to facility effect. And if that's the case, then it seems more reasonable that that should be an adjusted part of the SMR.
Well, if a facility were to see both the race-adjusted and the adjusted SMR, would that give them more information? Would that be clear? More could that help them figure out, you know, is there improvement better due to race mixture or facility effect?
Rather than me answering that, let me ask you a reciprocal question which may clarify it. Would it help you to see both an analysis which was adjusted for age and unadjusted? With the adjustment for age, you would know that whatever excess or deficit mortality is compared to patients of similar age. Without it, you may see high mortality, and is that because you're treating old patients or because you have adverse care? You don't know. Without the adjustment, you can't parse it apart as easily.
So you could give the results for a model with age and comorbidities without the race, or is that what you'd already done?
The red line is without adjustment for race in figure one.
Right. But it did include age and comorbidities.
Yes, it did.
Okay.
Thank you.
I mean, this is amazing new look at data, in fact, all data, and it brings back some of the thought process from 10, 20 years ago. And we realize how important some local factors, facility factors, race, age, even transplant factors get involved, and it's all very local. Trying to get realistic in all of this, I have a worry in that this will require a collective thinking process change completely. Networks, I mean the whole nation. Because we've been using this rule. I mean, we've been playing a sport, and now we're suddenly saying, okay, we're going to change the rules of the sport. And I wonder on reality check here is, I think we need to move this forward. We need to start moving the process into changing our collective thought process. But I'm not sure we can do that here in the measures we're doing. I mean, I'm now confused and concerned about how we may adapt this to what we're doing.
I actually don't think we should make any changes. I think we should continue to produce SMR adjusted for age. I think if any change, we should give facilities that second table that shows them their adjusted mortality by race, which is potentially actionable, as opposed to this, which is not actionable and I don't think very helpful.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, Ruben, I don't think this is, it's a great new view, but it doesn't change the way that we've been doing it. It endorses in my mind the strength of continuing to adjust for race in addition to age and comorbidities.
If the logic has been that there are differences in mortality by gender, race, and age, And while some of them may have to do with provisions of care facility, a lot of them don't have anything to do with it. And I think if we think about that in terms of age and gender, and there's data about race, to then make an exception, stop adjusting for race, I don't understand why we would want to do that.
Okay. I think that closes that topic for now.
Okay, so why don't we then we'll proceed through evaluating this measure. Who did we have assigned to present this
measure?
Jeffrey
Burns.
Jeff Burns. And we can walk through. Do you want to change your mind on the voting thing, Jeff? I think we can quickly go through the first ones here, unless you have something to say about impact. I think, should we go, any comments before we just go to vote on impact? Okay. Tanae, go ahead and start the clock.
High, moderate, low, and sufficient.
Lorian, impact?
Aye.
Thank you.
I'm actually presenting this.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
But I'm happy to turn it over to my senior colleague at all.
Yeah, let's keep it this way all day, right? Let's just roll along. 21 high, nobody moderate, low, or insufficient.
Okay. So now we will go to opportunity for improvement, and Michael, I'll let you.
I think there was general consensus. I don't know if you can pull off the Excel spreadsheet, but among the five of us who reviewed this, they had kind of presented that there was variation facility by this measure, and that there was need for improvement overall. So I think all of us had given 1B was a medium or a high. The big issue, which we've kind of been discussing for the last 15, 20 minutes, was the issue about disparity data, and that went into this whole thing about adjusting for race. I won't rehash that. But putting that aside, everyone else thought that there was some variation by facility and therefore opportunity for improvement.
Okay. Comments from the other assigned reviewers? Or?
All right, then. Let's vote on the performance gap. High, moderate, low, and sufficient.
Lorian, performance gap?
Aye.
Okay, 18 high, 3 moderate. So this is a health outcome.
Right. So on this one, all we need to do is there plausible relationships to healthcare processes and services that affect mortality?
And they do that later in the application, Karen. They kind of point out, I think it was in hemoglobin and anemia and KT over V or URRs from what I recall, that they had linked that with SMR.
So, yes.
Well, can I just explore for a moment? There are those correlations. Is there any evidence that affecting any of those measures affects this outcome?
My understanding, yeah, I think that there were correlations given. I don't remember that they had actually formally looked at that if you make a modification in something as an intervention, that changes SMR. I thought they were epidemiologic relationships, but I can be corrected, but that was my recollection of what was put in the document.
Can we ask the developer that question?
So actually, we've looked at it the other direction, maybe it's just what you're saying. We have looked at specific practices and seen whether facilities that carry out one practice have different mortalities than facilities that carry out other practices, and the answer is very clearly that's the strongest relationship that we feel we can document that's likely to get as close as possible to a randomized controlled clinical trial of differences between facilities. For example, if that kind of analysis does replicate the randomized controlled clinical trial results for EPO, showing that up to about 12, above 12, you do get the higher mortality when you look at it in its relationship to the standardized mortality. So that's the modifiable, several modifiable factors such as vascular access, adequacy of dose, and anemia management all are related to mortality. And I'll leave it to you to tell me which ones of those are modifiable.
I think Alan's question, if I'm understanding it correctly, is whether somebody has shown prospectively whether changing some pattern of practice changes SMR.
And we have not replicated that in with the Medicare data. All we have been able to do is look at practices that did change historically and correlate that with changes in outcome. Other individual studies have been prospective in nature and have yielded similar results, is my understanding.
And we'll look at that more closely at validity in terms of can you make conclusions about quality based on that. At this level, you can also look at the studies of treatments and treatment interventions at the patient level. Does it affect mortality in terms of whether, you know, there are healthcare practices that can influence patient survival or mortality rates?
Well, isn't it true that a given facility tends to do the same year after year, that a high performer tends to be a high performer, a low performer? Now, I think that is sort of, his evidence may be indirect, but that there is a facility effect and that there is, Alan's over there shaking his head, no. I mean, it's not the same as having a prospective clinical trial.
I mean, at this level, we're being asked whether there's a rationale that supports the relationship. And I personally, from what I've heard, think there surely is a rationale. I think that digging deeper into causality is something we need
right.
to do. But at this level, I'm comfortable with the relationship.
It's been linked to intermediate outcomes that are modifiable, right? Hemoglobin and UR or KT over V. I mean, albeit the strength of the evidence is born out of retrospective analyses of existing data.
And I guess my question is, can a facility that has a poor performance on SMR take action to improve it?
That's the whole question we're asking here, and there is not a clear answer, although the data that they've analyzed would suggest that the possibility is yes.
So should we formally vote on this sure. question? Okay. 1C, health outcomes. So if the measure is a health outcome, does a rationale support relationship to at least one healthcare structure, process, intervention, or service? Yes or no?
Tonight. And Lorian, yes or no for health outcome?
Yes.
Okay, 21, the magic number.
Okay, so let's move on then to...
That was 21, yes, for the record.
Okay, so let's talk about reliability, and then we'll get into validity. So, Michael?
Sure. So the reliability, they kind of talk about that they kind of have standard sources for death. And then they also kind of described, in terms of the expected, the Cox model, which we've kind of talked about at length already this morning, about what's included in the Cox model. I think the one thing that was raised by myself and other people and in the staff notes was the idea that the reliability, and we can ask the stewards for clarification, I think they may have responded a little bit to this in one of the documents, was their initial approach to the reliability was looking at SMR from year to year as a way of assessing reliability, and I think concerns were raised about
is that really answering the question of reliability, that type of methodology in the measure?
And let me just, Lauren, if you would bring up, right, they did some signal-to-noise analysis for the process measures, but not this outcome measure. So maybe we could have the developer, I don't think it was in there. Let's see.
So no, we did not do the signal-to-noise ratio analysis for that, but there are very substantial differences in the SMR from facility to facility. They vary typically with in a random effects estimation of the variation by about plus or minus 15% with regard to mortality. So that's a substantial amount, a clinically important amount of variation that the measure identifies. The motivation for putting in the serial correlation from year to year was we were thinking of that as a pseudo-experiment of having two different raters rate the same facility. And all we can do is look at it in one time period compared to another time period very close to it. So there are independent evaluations, but based upon different data. And the answer is that inter-rater reliability is quite high based upon that correlation. That was the logic behind that motivation.
I understand that. I guess the flip side is, if you believe what Alan said, that if my facility got a bad SMR, and hopefully I've done something right, a process change. I'm just trying to be devil's advocate for mitigate. If I've then done some process change that hopefully impacts this outcome, that maybe my SMR would change a bit more from year to year over some time period, right, depending on how effective we are. But I understand the idea that if we think that these things, on the other hand, are rather stable and that change is more insidious, then looking at inter-rater reliability from year to year isn't unreasonable.
Right. I think the concern of looking at that as reliability is that it's also different time periods and different patients even. And so it's even, you know, from that standpoint of trying to do it as a pseudo, it's really measuring something else.
Right.
Well, the fact, though, that the data is managed electronically, you know, at the level element reliability, it should be okay.
Right. So at the data element reliability, it's probably, I mean,
no, the data sources for death, I mean, the master death file and the death index, I think, are widely used data sources that I mean, are I don't think, they're imperfect, but I think they're fairly robust.
Well, the death data, is it the forms that are filed, or do you use these other ways to search for death?
So
it's facility reported deaths, right?
It's mostly reported deaths through the facility, from the death forms reported by facilities, but it is supplemented by the Social Security death master file, which increases about, that's where we ascertain, I think, about 10 or 15%. As a final step, the data are put up for facility review before they are made public on the DFR, and actually several facilities look at patient-by-patient lists of their patients to clarify that and verify that the data are entered correctly. So there, it is actually done at the facility level in addition to what is originally submitted.
And that, of course, is in their interest to do a good review of that. So I think that's another form of reliability check, isn't it?
So, and I guess the other question, since it's now so prominent in the risk model, is do you have any idea about the validity of the race data?
So,
and that's a validity question, so I should probably hold that. But
yes, it has been looked at, and I don't know the right answer.
Right.
But here's what I do know, is that there are standards for how race should be reported. It should be done as self-reported, and there are certain categories that should be included in the race specification. Right now, the data are taken largely off of the 2728 form, and I believe that has recently been modified, and that Jesse may be able to speak to this better than I can, it's supposed to now reflect self-reported rates, I believe. But.
Right. I don't think that has been implemented just yet. We have done studies comparing different sources of race and ethnicity data that we have. So we've compared to the UNOS transplant data and we've compared to the Medicare enrollment database, and we found very high agreement on ascertainment of white versus black. The other category is a little less so because it's a provider report, but we have seen high agreement there.
We've looked at this in VA. I mean, if the distinguishing between white and non-white is always pretty good with self-report. It's when you get to finer categories, Hispanic and Asian, that there's more problems. But the white, non-white is usually pretty good. I think the other thing about the 27-28 data, right, is that the comorbidities and some of the other data elements from it do suffer from underreporting and some problems. But that's a separate issue.
You can... just one last bit of clarification of Jeff's comment. The comparisons between white and non-white from the enrollment database and 2728 data sources is available in print in the American Journal of Kidney Disease article by Roach from 2010, which corroborates the high correlation between categories of black versus non-black. In text reflect some of the greater difficulties in differentiating between other ethnic and racial groups.
Okay, so I think, are we ready to vote on reliability?
Any other comments from the other reviewers, questions from the committee?
Okay, so let's vote on reliability. High, moderate, low, or insufficient evidence.
And Lorian, reliability?
Moderate. Thank you. 21. Okay, 7 rated at high, 14 moderate, none low, none insufficient. So moving on to validity then.
And this would encompass the validity testing and the risk adjustment model we've talked about. And Michael, you want
to talk? Yeah, I mean, I think some of this we kind of talked about. There were some concerns. I mean, part of it, the concerns were related around kind of the risk model testing and the modeling and the factors included in the models, which we've kind of discussed at length. You know, they related the SMR to anemia and UR, these other measures, these well-recognized intermediate outcome measures, and they showed kind of concurrence and correlations, which seemed to indicate that SMR is robust. And, yeah, I think that was, a lot of it, I think, hinged upon what we kind of discussed up to date, which was what are we all including in the models and the covariate selection and how well is that giving us kind of what we assume is the expected outcome. I think in general, I was trying to look back at the spreadsheet. I think in terms of the voting, I think most of the people on here, so it's a little bit hard to see. Oh, thank you. So I think, where's validity? Let's use the validity. Sorry, the spreadsheet's kind of wide. Okay, so it looks like everybody, I think there was an insufficient, the rest are medium or high. I think the insufficient probably, or I'll leave that individual, they can, but I think that might have been related to some of the questions we had that we've kind of discussed here to time.
I was a little bothered that validity was stated to because it showed some correlation with some other outcomes, and therefore it's a valid measure. I mean, how do you view that?
Well, for process measures, that's great, showing the correlation to outcomes. It's kind of, I guess, a question for all of you when you're looking at showing validity of the outcome measure, what's a appropriate test. And
I think the two parts of this measure, right, are observed deaths and expected deaths. Observed deaths, I think we probably agree that the sources being used are quite valid in determining observed death. I think expected deaths got to the whole discussion that we've already had about the model and what's included in the model. And essentially that is, how are we coming up with a value for expected deaths? And I think we've had a long discussion about that. You know, there are things that are just not known at this time. But I think that seems to me you're looking at the face validity of the measure, and in this one, the two parts of the observed and the expected deaths.
So it seems like we've talked about some, like you said, the validity of the death data especially.
Okay.
This is Lorian. Can I ask a minor question of the sewer just for clarification? One of the included adjustment variables is age-adjusted population death rates by state and race, but it's based on the U.S. population in 2001 to 2003. Can you just clarify why that data is still being used and if that will be updated soon?
Hi. Did you understand the question?
Yeah, I believe that might be an outdated reference.
Okay.
It is true, however, my understanding is that the data are lagged by more than a year or two because of reporting through our data source. However, the death rates by state and age are very stable over time, certainly over a few years period. We have worked as hard as we can to get the most current data available on that, but it is not as old as you've identified there.
So the source for that is the National Center for Health Statistics health publication that they put out annually. We use the latest data released each year.
Okay, so it's probably not the 2005 data.
Okay, other issues around validity before we vote? Okay, then let's go ahead and vote. The usual scale. High, moderate, low, or insufficient evidence?
Lorian?
For validity, high.
So 5 voted high, 16 voted moderate. So I think we can go on to usability then.
Yeah, I think we don't need to talk about disparities in this one.
I think quick work of usability, this has been a previously endorsed measure. It's publicly reported. It's used in dialysis reports. I don't think anybody, unless someone does now, I don't think any of us had concerns about it, so we can just move forward.
Well, from a QI front, I might say it's hard to know if you haven't had a low score, exactly what to do about it, but it is still, I think, a good process. So I think it's a little less usable for QI than it is for public reporting, but still usable.
And actually, my only comment on public reporting is that I think a very large percentage of facilities are as expected, with a relatively small above or below expected, the way it's listed. So it would be nice to have a little more differentiation from a consumer standpoint. I don't know if you guys have looked at the stats.
Yeah, only if that more differentiating was meaningful. So I got to be careful.
Yeah, agreed.
So are we ready to vote for usability? We're going to put both public and QI into one question. Okay. We'll vote high, moderate, low, or insufficient. Go ahead.
And Lorian?
Aye.
And we have 15 voting high, 6 moderate. So on to feasibility.
I think similar to usability overall, feasibility I don't think is much of a concern. I think all of the reviewers, including myself, rated this as high. I don't know if any new concerns have come up, but that's what the preliminary evaluations were.
Okay, let's go ahead and vote on feasibility then.
Go ahead.
Lorian?
Hi.
Just push the right number. Just, yeah.
Okay, votes were 20 high and one moderate.
You can, do you want to re-vote?
So overall, does the measure...
Yes, you did.
Overall, does the measure meet all the NQF criteria to be suitable for endorsement? Let's go ahead and vote. One yes, two no, three abstain.
Lorian, overall?
Yes.
We have 21 yes, zero no. Thank you.
Okay.
So,
okay, what we're going to do, using your suggestion about priorities with new measures and also some timing issues, is we have some new measures under mineral metabolism, and the developer is here this morning, so we'd like to at least have that advantage. So what we will do is, let's see, which ones are that? We have... Is it 1655? And we will go to 1655 and 1658. Those are the Amgen measures on parathyroid hormone. And why don't we have the presenter? Would you introduce yourself and then just briefly give an introduction to your measures?
Sure. Thank you for the opportunity to speak this morning. My name is Bill Goodman. I'm a clinical research medical director with Amgen. we have put forth two measures with respect to PTH monitoring that we think are important from the perspective of patient management and patient safety. several things have happened in recent years that raise concern about the management of secondary hyperparathyroidism in this population. This is a progressive disorder. Its severity increases over time, and it's been documented repeatedly in the literature that the severity of disease and ultimately the need for parathyroidectomy to manage it surgically is dependent on age, duration of chronic kidney disease, or length of treatment on dialysis or dialysis vintage. So these are consistent predictors of disease severity and its progression over time. With the development of the new KVIGO and KDOPI guidelines, some additional uncertainty has been introduced. Secondary hyperparathyroidism is incorporated into this broader syndrome of chronic kidney disease, mineral and bone disorder, and the attention to the disease of secondary hyperparathyroidism and its progression has somewhat been obscured. Additionally, the KVIGO and KDOPI working groups set forth thresholds at the upper and lower end for PTH that they designated as depicting areas of extreme risk. Unfortunately, most of the broader community have interpreted those ranges as target therapeutic ranges and in implementing updated practice guidelines. So what we've suggested on the monitoring of disease progression relates to measurements of PTH that exceed a value of 400. In our submission, whether one looks at populations using large dialysis provider databases or DOPS data, the percentage of patients with values above 400 ranges from 20 to 40%, and many of those individuals are untreated. Additionally, if one looks at a facility level, again, a substantial proportion of patients approaching 40% have elevations in PTH, and nearly half are untreated. So it's our contention and recommendation, and we feel it's consistent with the KVIGO and KDOPI guidelines, that recommend that PTH values be monitored and that trends, particularly upward trends for patients with values in the 3 to 600 range, be identified, and that interventions to prevent those values from exceeding the upper threshold of 600, which defines a level of extreme risk in the KDOPI view, be considered. On the lower end for PTH, this represents a somewhat different population, and many of these individuals do not have the disease of secondary hyperparathyroidism. Generally speaking, these individuals are older. There's a high prevalence of diabetes. Malnutrition is common. And some of these individuals may have undergone parathyroidectomy in the past. So clearly, they do not have the disease of secondary hyperparathyroidism. However, some individuals with very low PTH levels have been treated for secondary hyperparathyroidism effectively and perhaps overly treated, and their PTH levels suppressed in response to pharmacological interventions. Under these circumstances, for safety reasons, treatment reductions or withdrawal would be considered appropriate. The primary concern here relates to issues of fracture risk, potential for vascular calcification, although the evidence supporting those adverse outcomes is somewhat tenuous. Thank you.
Okay, Lisa. Okay, so we'll go back to our process of having the person introduce the measure and give a summary of the preliminary evals and raise any issues, and we'll do it criterion by criterion. So we'll start with impact.
Right. Well, and first of all, I want to thank Amgen for actually two very well-written proposals. So I thought that the proposals were very well-written, and I want to thank NQF for assigning them to me when I had to review things that I'd most happily forgotten since medical school. And I'm definitely going to need help from my nephrology colleagues in terms of the thyroid or the parathyroid calcium and phosphorus access. So as the Amgen folks said, this two proposals are regarding the use of vitamin D analogs and calcium emetics for high and low parathyroid levels. So so you want to go through, and instead of an overall, we'll go through measure by measure.
Do measure by measure and vote as we need to.
So the first measure then, 1655 ESRD patients with parathyroid hormone greater than 400 who are not treated with a calcium emetic or vitamin D analog. First, looking at importance and impact, fairly good agreement among the reviewers that this is something that is moderately to high importance, important to measure. Impact, yes.
Any other comments? Any comments on impact, or are you ready to vote on that? Okay, let's vote. And Lorian, impact?
Moderate.
Okay, the results are 8 votes for high, 12 for moderate, and 1 low.
Okay.
So performance gap.
Okay. So again, between the reviewers and within the document, they had review from a large dialysis organization and from the dialysis outcomes and practice study showing fairly significant variation, I thought, between patients and between facilities. So within patients, in the large dialysis facility, 16% of patients in the had would have been tested positive for this measure, and 25% in the DOT study. Within facilities, 39% and 42% respectively would have tested positive on this measure.
Okay. And other comments regarding performance variation? Okay, I think we're ready to vote on that point. So let's vote high, moderate, low, or insufficient.
Lorian, performance gap? Lorian?
Oh, I'm sorry, moderate?
Thank you.
Okay, the results, 8 votes high, 13 moderate. Now on to the body of evidence.
Right, quantity. So not a health outcome. So in quantity of studies, there were 9 publications reviewing 15 studies looking at the relationship of moderate to severe hyperparathyroidism associated with bone disease and risk of death. I think this is where we start to get controversial, and I think this will be a very engaged discussion. again, we'll defer to some of my nephrology colleagues as to the evidence, but I think that there appears to be a good link between the relationship of parathyroidism to bone disease. From there on, it gets a little fuzzier. And again, would like some of my esteemed colleagues to weigh in.
All right, so I'll wade in. The data, I think, are pretty clear about a correlation between the presence of high PTH levels and poor outcomes. I haven't seen any data, though, suggesting that altering that level affects outcomes.
Yeah. Let me. Hold on, I'm sorry. Mine went on first. So we do. Okay, I'll get myself in trouble. So there are no randomized control studies affecting that outcome, and as stated, the measure includes monitoring whether or not patients are on 2 classes of agents, vitamin D analogs another treatment. And that implies that is the right thing to do, but there's no randomized controlled trial data there. So to me, that's the conundrum. And then when KDIGO looked at this, and then there was a commentary, a U.S. commentary. Their conclusion, which we talked about in great detail in January, was that issues related to control of phosphorus and PTH did not appear to meet a standard for performance measures. So to me, that is my concern with incorporating drugs into this measure related to the monitoring of PTH.
The question I have, and the authors point this out in the performance metric brief, is that is this a randomized controlled trial that could be done, or would it be unacceptable to have a high PTH that remains untreated under today's practice standards?
I think it could and should be done. I think that Joe makes an important point that KDIGO did not feel that this should be a performance measure. And it also takes PTH, or looks at PTH in isolation. when really metabolic bone disease management is what is the calcium, what is the phosphorus, what is the PTH, what have been the trends in those over time, and as opposed to looking at only one laboratory value at one point in time in isolation, I think is actually bad care.
And particularly with the variability in PTH, there was a study that showed you have to check it like 50, I may get this wrong, but in double digits, the number of times you have to check it before you have a stable value. And I'm sure anecdotally, many of people here around the table in their own unit have rechecked PTH values and it's 600 and then it's 200. And I think that's why this study was done that showed the remarkable variability in this. And regardless of which assay you're doing, they looked at different ones. But then I think the second thing I just add is then what is the appropriate threshold? I think this gets into the variability in the assay. Here it's greater than 400. I don't know how great the evidence is for that. And particularly in the backdrop of a very fickle assay, I think that's very problematic.
The developer mentioned a safety signal. So I think we also, I want to make sure that we're clear about that, because my interpretation is that we need to consider a safety signal at the low end where we might have prescription of medicines where there's no indication for it. And I'll just ask the developer just to clarify if he mentioned safety. Are you concerned about safety at the low end, or is there any evidence of a safety concern at the high end?
I think we're concerned definitely at the high end. Again, our view is that this, and this evidence, I think, is compelling that this is a progressive disease. Once the process of parathyroid gland hyperplasia becomes established, it's a progressive disease. And I think KBGO actually acknowledges that in recommending that if there is biochemical evidence of progression, that an intervention to control that progression and to prevent values from reaching levels that are associated with extreme risk is appropriate. With respect to the PTH assay measurements, granted there are many commercial assays available, and they provide numerically different results. They are, however, all marketed under FDA scrutiny, and they satisfy the criteria that FDA establishes for marketed diagnostic products. So it's important for providers as well as clinicians to understand which assay is being used and how it relates to previous assays considered to be gold standard. But the reliability of these is greater than is generally discussed. Looking at any of these observational studies or looking at population data in a population receiving many different treatments, and 80 to 85% of this population are on a variety of treatments, short-term changes in PTH are readily understandable. We've looked at this in data sets in individuals with untreated disease. So they're not confounded by concurrent treatment with either vitamin D or a calcium emetic. And if one looks at individuals with values above 400 off treatment, then looks retrospectively over 6 or 12 months to document that they've received no treatment, the interval change over that 6 or 12 month period is in the range of 40 to 50% in terms of their PTH level. And if one looks at two consecutive measurements separated by 3 months, two-thirds to three-quarters of the time, the second measurement is higher than the one obtained 3 months previously. So I think there's good evidence in individuals who are not treated that this is a progressive disease. So to your point, Alan, I think there is risk at the high side in terms of disease progression.
Jeff.
Bill, do you have information available about bone disease itself or in these patients or sort of at these different PTH levels rather than just the PTH level? In other words, bone biopsy data.
We've just last week looked at data from a study that we undertook as a post-marketing commitment in Europe. And it is pretty clear that patients with PTH levels above 5 to 600, the overwhelming majority of them have evidence of hyperparathyroid bone disease, as documented by bone biopsy.
And were those patients naive to vitamin D analogs and calcium mimetics?
About half of them had previously been treated with a vitamin D analog. Very few had been previously treated with a calcium mimetic.
So this is, you know, I think it's clear that a good nephrologist is going to address a high PTH level as part of their care. And the issue I think we're grappling with is without good evidence that intervention makes a difference in key outcomes, is this something that should be a national quality forum voluntary consensus standard? Any other, before we start voting on the quality of the body of evidence, questions? Any more discussion?
If I could just add one more comment to address Jeff's point.
One more.
We certainly are not advocating looking at PTH in isolation, but it is an independent measure of the disease. There's no other parameter that can be measured other than bone pathology to inform about this disease, so calcium or phosphorus levels per se will not provide any diagnostic information whatsoever with respect to the presence, absence, or severity of secondary hyperparathyroidism.
Okay. Lisa, any other?
No, I think that, you know, as I find myself struggling with some of the evaluations for, you know, putting the discussion we just had in context with the NQF sort of structure, and that, you know, obviously there was a very robust body of evidence presented. It's just not directly on the question. So I think that's sort of the key thing to consider as we are voting.
Okay. Are we ready to vote first on the quantity of studies? You see in the chart, we can, 5 or more is high, 2 to 4 moderate, 1 would be low. Let's vote.
Lorian, quantity?
Moderate.
Okay, the voting 4 high, 11 moderate, 2 low, and 4 insufficient evidence. Okay. The next is the quality. High, moderate, are we ready to vote? Any other discussion here? Okay, let's go ahead and vote.
Florian, quality?
Moderate.
All right, we have 1 high, 7 moderate, 8 low, and 5 insufficient evidence. Let's go ahead and vote on consistency results across the body of evidence. High, moderate, low, or insufficient?
Lorian?
Moderate.
It's 21. We have 9 moderate, 6 low, 6 insufficient. So applying that to our algorithm, I think this would fit the third row, right? Quantity, medium to high, quality, low, consistency, medium to high. So this would pass if the potential benefits to patients clearly outweighs potential harms.
But no, I think
did I get that wrong?
I'm not sure I agree with that assessment. If you look at the consistency,
right.
Low and cannot determine were the majority.
Right. So.
What was the consistency?
If you go back to the result from consistency,
just display it again. Yeah, so it was low and insufficient, 12.
Okay, so we have to give that a low. The insufficient is hard to figure if that, how that should count, right?
Right. Well, it's insufficient means you really can't rate it, and I think we have to combine that with low versus just compare low to moderate. So
it feels that way. I'm not sure it means that. Because it may be that if they're saying if I had that insufficient evidence, I might feel high. You know, I might feel it's good. So, okay, so we're going to rate this as a low. I think this,
no.
As a
not passing evidence.
Well, then going back to the chart.
Go to the chart.
Go to the next. So then we would be down to the fourth line, the fourth row. Correct? Everybody agree? Okay.
So, any concerns about that? Because we can re-discuss if needed. So, basically, what we're saying is this would stop here because it didn't pass evidence.
Okay, so let's go to the next measure. 1658.
Sorry, this is the flip side overuse measure, looking at whether someone with a low pH or low PCH below a certain threshold, and that threshold has been chosen as 130, is being treated with a vitamin D analog or a calcium emetic. In terms of the reviewers, the initial importance was sort of all over the place, with three mediums, one high, and two lows. So definitely all over the place, although I would change my high to a medium in this after this discussion now. I think our previous discussion is still very valid in terms of I would assume there's not a lot of information also on the flip side of what to do with a very low PTH and the validity of improving that number by stopping one of these drugs, as well as the variation in the lab tests. So,
So let's focus on impact first.
Okay.
And see what the other reviewers wanted to say about
that. I misunderstood impact before coming, so I would change my low up there to a moderate, because I was focusing very narrowly on the impact of this. And Karen kind of elaborated, that's more of the broader impact of the topic area. So with that new knowledge, I would change my vote.
All right. Impact, high, moderate, low, insufficient. And Lorian?
Moderate.
One high, 20 moderate. So going on to the performance.
Going on to performance gap.
Was there any data on?
I'm just curious, in the application, was there any data maybe from Part D or from someplace to suggest how big a problem this is? Where there's simultaneous PTHs and drug utilization.
Funny you should ask that. That's the next one, performance gap.
That's where we're going.
Yeah, so that's where we're going right now. So the same two databases were used for the last one, a large dialysis organization using their electronic medical records, and then the DOT study. And in this, looking at low PTH still treated, they found that 60% of patients in the large dialysis facility, 46% of patients in the DOT study with serum PTH values less than 130, still treated with a vitamin D analog or a calcium emetic. And then on the facility side, 59% of the large dialysis organization facilities, 58% of the DOT study facilities had patients with a PTH less than 130 still being treated. So fairly large numbers that would test positive, quote-unquote, for this measure.
I found that pretty persuasive, and also thinking of this as a safety metric, you know, that's kind of alarming. We have to look deeper to really know exactly what's going on with those, but I found that persuasive.
The only comment I'd make is that's pretty old data at this point. It's from 2007. I think all of it, if not most of it. So it for whatever it's worth, it's rather outdated at this point.
And I have a question just for clarification, maybe from the steward, but one concern I had is this treats the treatment decision kind of dichotomous. Either you're giving treatment or you're not. And I guess one of the concerns, I'm sure others shared this, is what if the provider had made a substantial dose reduction in the vitamin D analog or the calcium emetic, or the calcium emetic. And this may be a limitation of the secondary data sources they were using, and then it also, I think, has concerns just for how this is written, but I want to make sure I understood from them that, I guess, that wasn't available, or is that something they were meant to incorporate in the way this is written?
Are you talking about access to, like, over-the-counter type?
No. In other words, if this treats you, either you were being treated with a vitamin D analog or calcimetic or not, in a case like this, what if the provider had made a substantial dose reduction in the medication?
And I had that exact same issue. Yeah. So there's a three-month window we're looking at. You get the VOD value, the provider makes a change, either stops or massively reduces the drug, and you would still test positive because they were on drug during that three-month window. So I think, you know, for us to, there would need to be an opportunity for the provider to get credit, quote unquote, for making the change.
Yeah, I certainly, again, you have to engage with the, you know, trending over time, sequential measurements. But, you know, at these levels, these are considered to be very low among patients undergoing dialysis. And so continuation of treatment here, you know, after dosage adjustment, you know, would really be considered over-aggressive use of both therapeutic agents.
But if within that 90-day window that you're looking at for the measure, someone is on drug, gets their treatment results, stops the drug, because they were on drug within that 90-day window, it's not 90 days after the positive test result with my reading of the measure. It's you get that test result. It could be that you get the test result in the last month of that 90 days. You were on drug up till that test result and then stopped it, and you would still test positive, unless I'm misreading and that's sort of getting into the part two in terms of the reliability, but unless I'm misreading it, that's how I'm...
Granted, there may be some refinement that needs to be done there for sequential testing.
All right, so are we ready to vote on the performance cap? Any other questions? Okay, let's vote. Wait, back up. Do we already vote on the performance? No. Okay, here we go. It's been a long 1.5 days.
Lorian, performance gap?
Moderate.
Someone out of the room? Let's go with 20. All right, 4 voted high, 15 moderate, and 1 low. Okay, so on to the body of evidence. This is, not an outcome. Right.
So there were 12 studies that were reviewed to look at the parathyroid hormone oversuppression in renal disease. Is seemed a little more on point to me than the last set, perhaps.
So discussion about the evidence, we'll talk about the quantity, quality, and consistency, and then go back and vote. So,
I just say I have similar concerns to the last measure where, one, this you have other parameters of bone metabolism that vary over time and are highly time-dependent, and this takes one and kind of takes it in a described time window. So I think those are important things in decision-making and trying to assess what's the best treatment strategy. And then the second thing is the ACVAX threshold. Once again, we have these defined thresholds. Here it's less than 130. How strong is the evidence for that particular cutoff, particularly taking into account the other comments that others have made about the variability, even within any given assay you do for PTH, and not having other bone metabolism parameters as part of kind of the gestalt of the overall impression of the patient's parathyroid disease.
I just heard comments about the quantity, and I haven't heard the committee's thoughts about the small committee's thoughts about the quality yet. So can we just vote on the quantity and then hear your quality comments?
Okay.
They mentioned that 12 studies were involved in the body of evidence. So, okay, let's go ahead and vote. High, moderate, low, insufficient.
Lorian, quantity.
Moderate. Okay. 11 voted high, 8 moderate, 1 low, and 1 insufficient. So to the quality.
So, and again, we'll ask my committee members here to help me weigh in on the quality. The studies, I think, were a little more on point as to the relationship between low parathyroid hormone and the morbidity associated with bone disease, cardiovascular disease, et cetera, no direct link to mortality. And then they also, and again, would like my committee members to help me, the Palmer study, looking at a sort of pseudo-meta-analysis, looking at 14 cohort studies, assessing the quality of evidence for the association between FOS, PTH, calcium, risk of death, and cardiovascular mortality, and there was not a tight relationship found in that study and that meta under that review didn't meet the criteria of meta-analysis, but in that cohort review. So the authors felt that this was not directly on point, and there were some problems with this analysis.
I have a fundamental struggle here, given the concerns at different levels about the evidence and the absence of black and white evidence. But on the other side, I do tend to view this as a safety monitoring issue. And if one has a very suppressed PTH on vitamin D analogs or calcium mimetics, I think most people in the room would want to remove those drugs, maybe without the most profound evidence in the world, but I think that's the right thing to do. But again, the concern with the measure as written is just what Lisa articulated. You might have drastically reduced or hopefully stopped, but the way the measure's written, you because of this 90-day window business, it may be perceived that patient on drug, yes, patient was on drug when his PTH was 300, but now you get the number back and it's 100. And you're going to stop it tomorrow or today, but so there's in my heart of hearts, I believe it's an important safety measure that we should consider, but otherwise there's a lot of flaws in the evidence per se.
And maybe what I would suggest is maybe let's vote on because I think you're talking about reliability, and I think we can fix it. If we want to proceed with the measure, I have some thoughts on how we could fix the measure to get to that in a more direct fashion. Because you're right, as written, it's not appropriate, I believe.
As a reviewer, I had the same dilemma that Joe's describing, that I don't think the quality of the evidence is sufficient, yet I agree that this is, you know, important, that in the sense that it's a safety measure and does it rise to the level of needing a national quality form standard? I don't, you know, that's what I'm debating in my own mind. I'm wondering if this could be one of those measures where we say the quality isn't there, but maybe the harm doesn't exceed the benefit exceeds the harm. Alan?
Just a quick clarification. The evidence shows the morbidity of low levels. The measure has to do with stopping the drug. Do any of the studies deal with stopping or not stopping the drug?
They actually, this is quite well written. I mean, on page 13, their last paragraph kind of states exactly that the overall quality of evidence supporting this, there's guidelines, but they say that there really is it's not clear what to do, or evidence about a level, a consensus about evidence for a PTH value which should trigger an action of any kind, whether we stop or dose reduce, or what action should be dose reduction versus discontinuation, is not very well known. And then they kind of go back to citing some things in guidelines, and I don't, which I think are more of a product of expert opinion again. So I think that it's quite well written and put together, and I think it underscores that there's a lack of evidence and there's uncertainty, but there is expert opinion floating around. And I guess then I think one has to weigh that expert opinion and lack of hard evidence versus the safety concerns that others have mentioned.
I actually think that, you know, when you guys are looking for an example of a really well-written review to get to potential measure developers, this would be a good example. It really is quite well-written.
But the conundrum here is that it is actually so well written that paragraph that was alluded to, I think, strikes it down. It seems to be the right thing to do, but we don't have clear-cut evidence. So it might be a clinical guideline, but it maybe should not be a performance measure.
Well, you know, I'm sorry, one of the things that we actually haven't talked about in this meeting, although I remember discussing it back in January, is that this is an untested measure, so would only if we endorsed it, you know, and again, I think there would need to be fixes first. Oh, there's no time limited anymore. Okay. Never mind.
And let me just remind you, too, because I think Peter mentioned it, that in this situation, as you're talking about, even though it might not pass evidence, if you really think this measure is a safety concern and the, you know, as Peter said, the benefits greatly outweigh the harm, then you can proceed on that basis. So I just want to be sure that you're aware of it.
Yeah, if the voting goes low for quality but moderate to high for consistency, then we have the option of saying yes, the without even doing anything extraordinary.
Right.
We can just say the benefit outweighs the harm. Is the next question that comes up. So, okay. Okay, thank you. Any other discussion before we vote on quality of the body of evidence? Okay, let's vote.
Lorian, quality?
Slow.
Okay. The lows have it. We have one high, three moderate, 14 low, and three insufficient. Okay, so let's go on to the consistency question. Any discussion about consistency? Okay, let's vote.
And Lorian?
Moderate.
All right. So we have 2 voting high, 10 moderate, 4 low, and 5 insufficient. So I think we can give this a moderate. We agree?
Yeah, I mean, it would be, right.
So that gets us to row 3, where we have moderate or high quantity, low quality, and moderate to high consistency. So now we can consider the question, if the potential benefits outweigh the harms, we can vote yes, and it would pass the evidence review. Discussion? Okay, can we vote then?
Okay, yeah, we can go ahead and vote here. That's fine.
So yes is the benefits outweigh the harms.
Yeah, if expert...
Right, this is actually if it hadn't passed evidence at all. So I think we could actually stop unless someone objects to the conclusion. Or do you want to go ahead and vote on it? That's fine.
Are there people on the committee who would argue that the potential harm outweighs the benefit of stopping the drug when the PTH level is low? No. Okay, so I think we can just say that it passes on that.
Okay. And we'll give that rationale.
Okay. Okay, so we can move on to reliability and validity.
So the numerator here is the number of patients from the denominator with PTH less than 130 who continue to be treated with a calcium emetic agent or a vitamin D analog. There's a 3-month reporting window. The denominator is anyone on hemodialysis or PD, 18 years of age or older, been in the facility for 30 days, who've been on dialysis for greater than 90 days. We've talked previously about some of the issues with this in terms of any time within that 90-day window, is my understanding, if you have a PTH less than 130, and if any time within that 90-day window you're treated with a vitamin D analog or a calcium emetic, you are in the testing yes category. So there's no sort of sequential time issue, which, again, I think could potentially be fixed with some fixes to the sort of, you could use an index event of the PTH and then look for a 90-day window after that or have some sort of, I think this could be fixed if we decide it's important and want to proceed, but I think as currently written, it is not testing what you want to test, which is that does the facility and or the physician or clinician appropriately make a change to therapy as a result of the test.
So Lisa, if that's right, and I think you're right, do we try to fix it now or do we vote on the flawed current measure?
I think what we've learned is it's best to vote on the measure as it is, and if someone wants to try to suggest a change, that way we'll know where we're at better. And also, I'm sorry if I missed it, did you talk about reliability testing as well, besides the specifications?
I did not. So reliability testing was not done. Was it? Validity testing was not done. Thank you. So they use the large dialysis organization with the EHR. And again, we have all the issues we discussed yesterday using EHR data and some of the issues there.
Okay, so they were invoking that they were doing data element test validity testing, and then we allowed them to skip reliability. So we can
we'll address that under validity. Yeah. But Ruben?
I would like to add here, if possible, maybe for the steward to think about an exclusion. Some networks are beginning to see more parathyroidectomies. Those patients will need vitamin D analogs initially to maintain calciums, and they will have a low PTH. So I think we should think about that exclusion.
Say that again, Ruben. I didn't follow. Which group you're thinking of excluding?
Patients that had a recent parathyroidectomy that need to be on vitamin D analogs.
Under specification, all this sort of maybe overlaps in the feasibility a bit, but I'd like to ask the developers. You mentioned the data source could be Crown Web data, but have you worked on agreement with CMS or that, you know, once, if this is passed, who's going to actually be doing the data? Where does the data come from? Does Amgen do the calculations, and where will you get the data?
Yes, we had a very brief email conversation with Tom Dudley, and we suggested that in the data field, which they currently have in Crown Web, where they collect vitamin D, that they also collect calcium emetics. We also indicated that it would be necessary for them to provide the conversion, you know, given, you know, specification on which assay was used at each of those facilities. And so we've just had the initial conversations, so there's no agreement in place.
Okay, so basically you're going to make you would make this available to CMS to use, otherwise it wouldn't be probably used, is that right?
And if any NQF endorsed measure can be used by anyone,
right? Although they have to go to the measure steward to make sure that they're doing it right. In general,
it would be the it would be the endorsed measure. Are you ready to vote on reliability, which includes specifications, on the measure as is, and then if it doesn't pass here, you can bring up, if someone wants to propose a modification, you can do that.
Okay, so are we ready to vote on reliability? Okay, let's do it.
Lorian, reliability?
Low.
That's 21. One high, 3 moderate, 16 low, 1 insufficient.
Okay, so that would not pass. All right.
I don't understand what the logic. I must. Well, somebody in the majority explain to me why they're feeling the reliability is low. I'm just
the specification issue that we've discussed.
That I?
No, Lisa was the main proponent.
That it doesn't, that the measure is specified does not look at whether somebody appropriately responded to a low PTH level.
Thank you, okay. So it was really the specification, not the reliability issue. Okay, thank you. All right. So do we stop here, or do we move on? Because this is kind of a deal killer at this point.
This would be a deal killer. So the question is whether someone wants to propose a modification to fix the specifications, and then we could vote on it. Are we? So
I thought we were voting on it. I thought the last vote was voting on reliably as is, and it included specifications. I just want to make sure I voted on what I thought
right.
I just voted on.
You're
that's right.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Kind of.
And maybe let's do this so we don't confuse things. Let's go ahead and vote on validity as well, and then we can talk about potential modifications if someone wants to bring that up. That way we won't get kind of confused at where we're at.
Okay, Lisa, so how was validity demonstrated?
Okay, so validity was demonstrated using testing from this large dialysis organization using data on 43,000 patients. They looked at this database and also 81 facilities from ADOPTS data. They found that
let me look. Basically, the data showed that they could get the measures out of the data sets. Again, and this was EMR data, so it was not Crown Web data, so it's a little different from the sets we've had currently. There is the issue that the developers mentioned just a minute ago that the calcium mimetic is not in the Crown Web database. So they have asked CMS, and CMS has apparently agreed via this email conversation, to instruct facilities to use the vitamin D analog element if the patient is on either a calcium mimetic or a vitamin D analog. So there's a little bit of an issue there. There also is the issue that was mentioned in the last, actually it's we didn't get to it in the last one. Apparently, and you guys again might know a lot more about this than I do, there's some problems with the PTH test in that there's not comparability across testing. So the reference range from one test is not comparable to the reference range in another test. So there are calculations that have to be done to normalize the ratio between testing, which seems to me to be quite a nightmare, and I think causes some significant problems in how this test would be interpretable, because you can't use 130 as an absolute cutoff. There needs to be some machinations depending on what test your particular reference lab is using to translate that into 130. So I see that, you know, while there are calculations that can be made to normalize it, I see this as a bit of an issue and a problem.
I'd just like to clarify one thing. Even though we've talked that they were trying to address data element validity, they really didn't get at data element validity. They had aggregate numbers that they compared to study data, so we still don't necessarily know.
It's not been tested in its form, yes. It's the elements tested via the scientific databases, the research databases.
And it's at a very high level, so we don't really know it's a data element.
So just to clarify, there, CMS, there's no reporting right now from dialysis facilities to CMS for any of the vitamin Ds, is that correct? The facilities don't currently report vitamin D use,
no.
Oral,
yeah.
Intravenous, or calcium mimetic use, so
no.
There's no way to know whether...
not current.
All in billing.
Only billing data, both for IV, for all data. For all
okay,
nothing.
Wait.
Calcium mimetic.
And what about the PTH level? Is that being recorded?
Okay. But that's clinically enhanced data. You should be able to get that through the lab vendors. Not easy, but possible.
So the question right now is, we're talking about a specific measure that's been put before us using particular data elements, and did they demonstrate validity of the data or of the score that will be used? That's the question for the measure that's being presented.
Right. I guess so. That's what I was going to ask again, Karen, because as you're the expert who understands the mechanism of validity testing, and I understood your comment to be that the elements were not there to test validity, so we don't have any information on validity. Is that correct?
It seems that way to me from looking at what they provided, and maybe we can pull that up in the application, the 2B2.
I think the interpretation currently is insufficient, would be...
I think they're trying to make the case that if they had the data, it would be valid. You know, as I'm reading it, they...
Well, I think they had data from the LDOs, as Lisa was saying,
right.
And they looked at... So they...
And they compared it to DOPS data.
And they looked at kind of aggregate numbers and then said, well, this is similar to what's in the DOPS database, but it's not specifically looking at the data for this patient compared to some authoritative source of the data for that patient. So that's all the point I'm making in terms of what does that show when you're...
I thought the idea is that DOPS is kind of the gold standard because DOPS is a prospectively controlled study, right, where you had, research assistants asking patients and writing down their medications. So I guess I thought the idea was is that they were showing that the data we were able to extract from an LDO correlated highly with DOPS data, which is a gold standard in terms
right,
of...
Right, but is it the same facilities and same patients? That's the question.
It's not, because DOPS is right, a worldwide study on several different continents, and this is from some LDO in the United States. So I would... No, it's not the same patients. So it's an indirect... I think it's like other... I'm just saying it's other examples we've talked about here today and yesterday where there was an indirect way to try to use correlation, not with over... with samples that are not exactly the same in an attempt to demonstrate validity.
They did say they used U.S. DOPS. They didn't use worldwide DOPS.
I overlooked that.
And so an LDO, the two big LDOs are national companies, and you would expect the DOPS in their population should be very similar.
And do we have that up to the results? Tables 9A and 9B. Can you bring those up?
Well, table 8 is the first part of the results, and then 9A and 9B is the second. There's actually two tests that are... Bill, you're invited to explain, or one of you, the validity testing.
Well, I mean, the data that were used here are essentially equivalent to the kinds of data that would be reported to CMS or to Crown Web.
But this is basically population level. It's not even at the facility level, right?
Correct.
So okay.
Correct.
So I think you all can weigh that, as Michael was saying, but we're just pointing out what it, you have to know what it is and isn't telling you.
Okay, so are we ready to vote on validity? Any other discussion? Okay, let's go ahead and vote.
Lorian, validity?
Thank you. Some may have voted too soon because it took a while for it to come up, so you might want to vote again. Here we go. Okay, we have 3 moderate, 6 low, and 12 insufficient. Okay. So we have 2 problems with both specification and validity. Short of getting Crown Web going, which they can't do immediately.
Yeah, I mean, I think even if we fix the reliability issues, which we, might be able to fix, we have the validity issue, and I just think it might not be ready for prime time this round.
I mean, unless someone has a suggestion so we have a couple things here, but one kind of impacts the other. So we do accept face validity, and that's something that they could address in a relatively short time, but that means then they would have to do something about reliability testing, and I don't know if...
Or specifications.
And also definitely the specifications. So At this, so I don't know, you know, how strongly the committee feels about asking the developer to think about these things rather than proposing. Joe?
Just a point of clarification about existing endorsed measures. Is there any endorsed measure in ESRD related to PTH monitoring without these drugs involved? In other words, there's no measure that looks simply at a low PTH, correct? Thank you.
Kathleen.
I might just remind everybody that the conversation was that this is a safety issue and that this is an evolving process, so it might be worth our time to see what we could do to make this, you know, address the deficits.
Yeah, I agree with Kathleen. Rather than drop it, my advice would be that we go on with this with the recommendations of validity, you know, and specification testing as we've discussed for the developers to give us.
Yeah, fortunately or unfortunately, it's clear that our work isn't going to be done today and that there would be a several-week period of time for them to address some of these specific concerns.
So do you want to take a few minutes to talk about what the specification changes you're thinking would be useful so that we can give them that input, and then we will follow up with them about how we can address the other aspects?
I mean, my suggestion, and definitely open to helping refine this, would be to use the PTH level as an index event and then look at the, you know, the 30 or 60 days after that event for prescriptions of a vitamin D analog and calcium emetic to, you know, give the facility and the clinician time to affect change after the results are obtained. It's obviously a more complicated measure. You would have to exclude folks that had a subsequent PTH that was above that range that were then restarted. So you'd have to, there has to be some machinations, but I think it could be done.
The other suggestion might be to look at this, again, be complicated, but use the cutoff value of 2 times the upper limit of normal for that lab rather than a specific number. I think the recommendation from KDIGO and others reflecting the variability of the assays or differences between assays is that the rather than 130, the appropriate number might be 2 times the upper limit of normal for that lab's assay.
So that's something for consideration.
And then the other specification, was there consensus that all vitamin D analogs and calcimetics should be stopped? Or is it the idea that stopping one or the other, if someone's on both, or a dose reduction if they're on one, is reasonable in terms of, I mean, I guess that's one of the things I have a little bit of trouble with, that it's kind of written, once again, binary, dichotomous, everything is stock or not.
Well, what I was wondering is when we did the hypertension measure yesterday, was it just yesterday, there was a plan, a treatment plan, and could it be something like that where there's a treatment plan to address the low PTH?
I'll just say that those are even more complicated.
I know.
That's
yeah.
Why I'm sort of hesitant.
It involves chart review or other levels. Of...
But I guess the other question, because we, in the last project, we had the kind of safety measure for the hypercalcemia, I believe, and it was just the level and not associated with drugs. And so my question to you is, would that make sense in this respect?
No. Okay. It's different.
Okay.
And if I may comment on, I completely agree with Michael's comments, because one size doesn't fit all. This is a complex, I mean, it's so patient dependent, depending on other factors on what you might do. It would be not good to mandate, let's say, or assume that we mandate stoppage of both.
Sure.
Just a point of clarification, since this specifies 5-D analogs, should the patient have a low 25-hydroxyvitamin D, it would not preclude them being on vitamin D itself, vitamin D3. Is that correct?
Yeah, this doesn't address vitamin D3, right, Bill?
Right. We're specific of vitamin D analogs, not native or nutritional vitamin D.
And the other issue about validity is to consider making the case as face validity with appropriate, addressing appropriate related issues on that instead of this type of validity. Ruben?
Just remind the possible exclusion that we mentioned earlier.
For post-parathyroidectomy patients. That should be an exclusion.
I mean, one of the things is that there may be a limit, because when you talk about provider actions, particularly when it's dosage reduction, someone with blood pressure, I think this becomes very challenging because it becomes complicated, as Karen Hayes or Karen mentioned, and also because it becomes, not only get to kind of write an algorithm, but then to actually have data such as that. So let's say you were able to write something where it was a dose reduction. How are you gonna go to Crown Data or somewhere and be able to figure that out, you know, be able to establish that change in action over time? This gets, I guess, now to feasibility. And I don't want to start muddling issues, but just as we're talking about responses back to the steward, I think correcting one thing may lead to difficulties elsewhere down the road.
The other thing I think to think about is that, you know, from performance measurement standpoint, you can't expect to have a standardized measure that will encompass every exception. And so the question to you all is, so if it's left as is with expecting, you know, kind of the on-off, is that going to add in a variable way affect scores of facilities? Are patients going to be kind of, you know, is it a random occurrence? Is it a big issue? I mean, that's the other thing, is that if it's a small minority of patients, then it's not going to affect overall performance scores, and we don't have to expect 100% or 0% on this kind of measure. But if it's something that's variable across facilities, you know, so we have to kind of think about that too.
It may be that zero isn't the right percentage. 10% may be correct, you know, and so you can compare. It's a facility level measure. So if one facility is 50% and the rest are 10%, then you have an issue. But if it was 12, 13, 8, 9, that's not a significant variation.
Well, and I wonder if we could use persistency to help us, in the sense that what if we were to do something like suppressed PTH levels in subsequent months. In that case, would it be much clearer that the drug should be stopped as opposed to just reduced?
Peter, it seems to me that with all the discussion we've had here today, to try to figure out how to fix this in this meeting doesn't make any sense. It would seem to me that either this needs to go and come back in a different form with more thought, or there needs to be a group put together to kind of think through this with the contractor to make this happen. We could sit here and debate this all day.
You're exactly right. What we've done, I think, is offered some advice to the developer. Issues that are concerned to the steering committee and offer them a short time window to address this if they wish to. And that's all we can do at this point. Thank you. Okay. Without sage advice from Stephen, let's take a 10-minute break. We'll resume at 20 minutes to.